From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Seeing the Jaguar and Other Tales from the Shaman's Apprentice, we talk with ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin about the plants and the medicine men of the tropical rainforest in the Amazon and what they have to offer Western medicine. Also, Tales and Poems from the Reservation, a talk with Native American writer Sherman Alexie. He began writing just 5 years ago, and now he's being hailed by the New York Times as one of the major lyric voices of our time. And television critic David Bianculli reviews NYPD Blue, the controversial cop show which premieres tonight. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian President Boris Yeltsin is attempting to dissolve the Soviet-era parliament that has resisted his economic and political changes. The parliament responded with an emergency session that declared Yeltsin impeached and named Vice President Alexander Rutskoy as acting president. It's not clear which side will finally make its decrees stick, but the Russian Defense Ministry has said it, and presumably the country's military, will stay out of it. Opposition lawmakers responded to that by voting to oust the ministers of defense and security. President Clinton has endorsed Yeltsin's action, and Secretary of State Warren Christopher said that although the United States got little warning, the move came as no surprise.
Impasse between the parliament and President Yeltsin was quite apparent over the last several days, and now that we see this action today, looking back over the events of the last week or two, it brings into focus some things that were said at the time. But as far as advance warning, we had only an hour or so's advance warning.
Christopher said the Senate should go ahead with the Russian aid package it's now preparing. He said the reasons for the aid are now even stronger than they were before Yeltsin's declaration. The head of the Clinton administration's special mission to Haiti says he still believes it's possible for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to return to office by the end of October, despite the recent upsurge of violence by the deposed president's opponents. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from Port-au-Prince.
U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Alexander Watson met this morning with the Haitian military leaders who overthrew Aristide 2 years ago. He said he conveyed the Clinton administration's unshakable support for Aristide's return, adding that he came away from the meeting with the impression that the army is still committed to the agreement it signed in July to return Haiti to democracy. Haitian security forces have stood aside over the past 2 weeks as gangs of plainclothes police agents have killed Aristide's supporters and disrupted the efforts of Aristide's prime minister to reinstall a civilian government. Despite the violence, Watson told a news conference he still believes Aristide can and will return to office by the deadline of October 30th.
We believe that's possible, and we are working as hard as we can to help that come about.
Watson said the Clinton administration would hold the Haitian security forces responsible for the civilian government's security. He categorically ruled out foreign intervention, describing it as a terrible idea. In Haiti, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today in reaction to the turmoil in Russia. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 38 points to close at 3,537. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Ukrainian President Leonid Kravchuk appealed for calm and nonviolence today after the country's prime minister and his government resigned. The Ukrainian parliament allowed the government to resign, ending a months-long power struggle between the prime minister and President Kravchuk. Ukraine's government has been unable to reform the troubled economy of the former Soviet republic after almost 2 years of independence. Abortion activists are facing off over President Clinton's health care plan. Lawmakers on both sides of the issue say their final votes may hinge on whether or not abortion is covered under the plan, but the administration has yet to show its hand. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Drafts of the plan include comprehensive reproductive health services. Administration officials say that means abortions. But President Clinton has not explicitly said this. Nevertheless, the fight has begun. Anti-abortion activists vow to block or defeat the plan, which Republican Chris Smith says is extreme, radical, and out of the mainstream.
This flies in the face of the purpose of health care reform, which is protecting the weak, the vulnerable, and the sick. In a word, this provision is anti-child.
Smith says those who are morally opposed to abortion should not have to pay for other people to have them. But abortion rights supporters say exclusion of abortion services from the health care plan is anti-woman and unacceptable. Both sides warn today that their objections could block the entire health care plan. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A new study suggests that women may be more likely to develop lung cancer from smoking cigarettes than men are. The study says that overall, female smokers may face about twice the cancer risk of men who smoke the same amount. Among the heaviest smokers studied, female smokers showed 82 times the lung cancer risk of non-smoking women, while male smokers showed only 23 times the risk of non-smoking men. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. For 15 years, Mark Plotkin has spent time with Indians who inhabit the rainforests in the northeast corner of the Amazon Basin in South America. This lush and diverse part of the world houses an astounding array of medicinal plants which have been used by native tribes who have lived there for thousands of years. Plotkin is an ethnobotanist and apprenticed himself to tribal healers to better understand the medicinal uses of Amazonian plants. He's concerned not only about the destruction of rainforest plants, but also worried that the knowledge of the tribal healers will be lost as well. Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice is Plotkin's account of his education in the rainforest and his efforts to preserve the wisdom of the tribal healers. Plotkin was educated at some of the finest schools in the states, Harvard, Yale, and Tufts, but he said nothing compared to what he learned about plants and medicine from the shamans and the people who lived in the forest.
When we look at the forest, we see a source of green, a source of timber. But when these indigenous peoples look at it, they see a drugstore, a toy store, a perfume store. You name it, and they can make it from rainforest products. And as a drugstore, it's a supermart. It's a Walmart. It's the biggest and the best of everything. You've got treatments there for just about every disease that afflicts our species, and many diseases which haven't arisen yet, and possibly diseases from which we suffer, for which we, as of yet, with Western medicine, have no cure.
Tell us what we use. What is in our medicine cabinet that comes from the rainforest?
Well, recent estimates are about 12% of our prescription drugs come from rainforest plants, and there's many other non-prescription drugs that come from there as well. Curare, used by the Indians as an arrow poison, used by us in Western medicine as a muscle relaxant abdominal surgery, comes from the jungles of the northwest Amazon. Reserpine, which is an important hypotensive agent, that is, it slows down the heart rate or the blood pressure, comes to us from Indian snake root. Many of the things used in the dentist's office, like Novocaine, is actually a synthetic based on cocaine, which comes from Western South America. There's many, many plants out there that already benefit us from the rainforest, and what I think is worth emphasizing is how many more are out there that can benefit us if we protect the forest, if we collect the information on which of these plants are useful from the people who know these plants best.
Tell us how an ethnobotanist works, and that's what and who you are.
Well, an ethnobotanist's job is to work with tribal peoples to find new and useful plants, usually in the tropical rainforest, and every one of us has our own methodologies. I tend to go into the forest with a shaman or a medicine man or a witch doctor, what have you, and with a young member of the tribe. And the young member usually speaks several different languages, which makes it easier to communicate, and also very adept at climbing these trees, which soar into way up into the canopy, 120 feet. And I place myself behind the medicine man and in front of the younger fellow to show the medicine man that I'm there to follow his lead. And also, because we're really the dim country cousins in the big city for the first time, and we're in the rainforest with indigenous peoples, they like to look out for you and keep you in between them so you don't do something stupid like pick up the wrong plant or step on a snake or something that no self-respecting indigenous person, no mistake they'd ever make.
Describe for us, if you can, then, how these people do live in the rainforest. What does a village look like?
Well, what makes life in the rainforest possible is plants. And when you go into these villages, what you see is people and plants. The houses are made from palm thatch. They may be shaped like igloos. They may be shaped like beehives. They may be shaped nothing more than lean-tos. The poles in the houses are forest saplings. The women are sitting there grating cassava, which is a forest plant which has been domesticated by these peoples, grating, grating, grating. You always hear that ch-ch-ch-ch-ch sound in every indigenous village. The little girls may be making bread from the cassava. The men are sharpening their arrows, which are made from forest plants, ready to go out hunting. Their bows are made from forest trees of the fig family to go out hunting. Everything is made from forest plants.
How would you describe their relationship with the forest around them?
Well, I'd say pretty much they're very much a part of the ecosystem, and I mean that as the highest compliment. They are in and of the ecosystem itself. They know the ecosystem better than any university-trained botanist does. And remember that none of these plants were learned of by Harvard or Yale or Cambridge or Oxford-trained botanists. They were all discovered like Columbus discovered America. The Indians got there first. And when they're living their traditional lifestyle, they're part of the ecosystem. But when we go in there with our religion or our technology and begin to disrupt their traditional relationship, with even the best of intentions in many cases, they start to lose their dependence on the rainforest, and that cycle is broken.
Describe for us, if you can, your introduction, and there was a guide you had named Fritz, and it seemed the way you wrote about it that this was really your first introduction into the rainforest, where the job was to try to understand the plants that were all around you.
Well, Fritz von Thrun is the greatest botanist I've ever met. This is a barely literate man of a Maroon tribe, which is a tribe of Afro-Americans. These were Africans brought to the Amazon in the 17th and 18th century to be slaves on the sugar plantations. These guys took one look around and said, hey, this is equatorial rainforest, we'll see you white boys later, and took off for the interior where they maintain what are essentially West African tribal lifestyles to the current day. And Fritz von Thrun, it sounds like a good Dutch name.
Yeah,
I expected
sure
this little Dutch boy with a page boy haircut and wooden shoes, and here was this huge, muscular Afro-American man who turned out to know more about botany than I could ever hope to learn.
Well, describe for us how he took you into the forest and how he related to the plants around him.
Well, he took me into the forest and began to show me the many uses they have for plants, not just medicines, but drinks, but vines to make ropes or hammocks, plants used by his ancestors to survive when they'd escaped into the jungle to escape the overseers. And it was really an eye-opener because I began to see that this wasn't something just beautiful, but really something that could provide all the sources to make life possible.
Well, I got the feeling, the way you wrote, that every step of the way was, at least for you, this whole new drugstore, if we can use that again, of plants. And around the next corner was a whole other one.
Every step into the rainforest the first time was a revelation, because every few feet there'd be a medicine or a fiber or an essential oil or some sort of useful plants. And it just showed me how, with my Western education being turned loose in the rainforest, I was just in a sea of green. But with an indigenous or a semi-indigenous guide, all of a sudden you understand how to use the forest, how these things can benefit us. And it makes you appreciate not only the potential of these species which are being lost, but the importance of the knowledge of these species, which really exists in the heads of the men and women who know the forest best.
What kinds of sicknesses do people get who, the indigenous tribes who live in the rainforest?
Well, of course, the great tragedy of these introduced diseases, for which they often have no cure. Now, you give these guys another 20,000 years, and maybe they can find the cure for the common cold, but they haven't had 20,000 years to find plants against it, only 500 years since it's been introduced. But nonetheless, I think a very important point worth underlining is that the greatest scourge in human history is malaria. Malaria has killed more people than any other two diseases combined. And the frontline drug for malaria is quinine, which comes from Western South America. Now, quinine was first discovered and taught to us by the South American Indians. So they did, in those 500 years, find the cure to the greatest disease from which people have ever suffered.
My guest is Mark Plotkin. He's an ethnobotanist and the author of a book called Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. Tell us what they thought of you, at least as you could figure it out when you arrived there. It seemed like you were the source of a lot of amusement to the local people.
Well, this is why it's so ironic to ethnobotanists to see these movies like Medicine Man, where the great white medicine man goes in and teaches the Indian everything. The fact of the matter is, you're just kind of a dim-witted country cousin to these people in the big city for the first time. And they regard you, at best, as a harmless oddball, and at worst, as sort of a silly interloper who's there to teach, to try and steal, actually, their tribal secrets. When I went into the first Indian village which I worked in, they referred to me as the Pananakiti, which means the alien. And so they didn't even regard me as the same species. They thought I was from another planet. But only by spending time with these people and building up a relationship based on trust and friendship and even love that they really began to open up to me and teach me the secrets of the plants they knew and used.
Well, we should also add that you were known as White Man Who Falls on His Ass.
Yes.
How did you earn
Banana
that
kiri,
name?
Banana Kiri no Nota Tementa, which is the white man who falls on his ass. I was working with this old witch doctor, at least I went to work with him, and we're going across this forest stream. Now, what we think of as a bridge is something you can drive across. These guys fell a forest sapling maybe 2 or 3 inches across and then dance across it like a little deer. Well, I went across it with this great medicine man and ended up ass over tea kettle. Well, he thought this was the funniest thing he'd ever seen and labeled me the white man who falls on his ass. And 8 years later, every year I'd go back there, he'd say, look, it's the white man who falls on his ass. So 8 years later, I was convinced this really wasn't as funny as it was almost a decade earlier, but he still got a tremendous charge out of that.
How does one become a shaman?
Well, traditionally, it varies from culture to culture and tribe to tribe. And with the Tirios, which is the tribe that I know best, you had to apprentice yourself to the medicine man. It was often the son of the medicine man, or it was somebody who had to volunteer or was chosen by the medicine man. You had to undergo 4 years of training, which is equivalent to a university education. You had to go through certain dietary restrictions. You had to put up with certain sexual restrictions. You then had to take a very hallucinogenic plant to commune with the spirit world. And then you had to learn which plants and which chants could be used to cure people.
What position do they hold then within the local society?
Well, traditionally, the two paramount positions in this tribe were the chief and the medicine man. But with the advent of missionary activity, the medicine man has been very much discredited because with the introduction of introduced medicines, which are highly effective against introduced diseases, and with an introduced religion, some of these people had a vested interest in saying the medicine man was really a person from the past who had no role in the future of these societies. So you still have the chief, and in many of these villages, you still have the medicine men. But in a lot of cases, the medicine men are dying out, and that's where the race comes in to save this information before it irretrievably disappears.
You worked with a master healer who you called the Jaguar Shaman. Tell us how you came to call him that.
Well, I'd worked with this old medicine man for 3 days, and it was a very enigmatic relationship because he never smiled, but he always scowled, in fact, and he obviously resented the fact that I had come from so far away to learn his sacred tribal secrets. By the same token, he obviously really appreciated the fact that I wanted to learn from him, whereas the young people in his village had no interest in the old ways, and he referred to me again as the Panana Kiri, the alien. So after 3 days, he turned to a YY Indian who was interpreting, since I didn't speak Tirio at the time, and said, tell the Panana Kiri that I've taught him all I'm going to teach him. He says, tomorrow I'm going hunting. Well, that night I was sleeping in my hammock, and I had an incredibly vivid dream of this enormous jaguar strolling into my hut and fixing me with this incredible scowl. I woke up with a scream and a cold sweat and looked around, but there was nothing there. No footprints on the dirt floor, just the sound of the wind blowing through the palm trees at the edge of the village. Well, the next morning, the YY Indian came to my hut and said, let's go look for some more plants. And I said, no. I said, go find the old shaman before he goes hunting and tell him that last night I saw the jaguar. Now, mind you, I gave no further explanation. Well, the fellow went off and came back a few minutes later, and I said, did you find him? He said, yes. I said, did you tell him? He said, yes. I said, well, what did he say? He said he broke into a big smile and said, that was me.
How did you interpret both the dream and his reaction to your dream?
Well, if you know the anthropology of South American cultures, you know that the jaguar is often the symbol of the shaman. The jaguar is the most powerful animal in the forest. The jaguar is the most frightening animal in the forest, and the jaguar walks and hunts by night. And there's tale after tale after tale of shamans claiming they can turn themselves into jaguars. Now, was this a dream? Was this a hallucination? Was this me reading too much anthropological literature? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it broke the ice between us, and ever since then, this fellow has treated me as sort of an adopted son and taught me many, many, many healing plants that just weren't being shown to me at the outset.
Did it free you in any way from the kind of reality that you brought into the Amazon rainforest, the villages there?
I think what it taught me was that these separate realities do exist, and that being willing to put aside your own preconceptions and to be willing to open your eyes to things that they consider very real or these alternate realities opens a sort of line of communication which is not open to some hotshot scientist trained in some ivory tower institution and a guy in a breechcloth. And when you realize that these people know things you don't, that these people can teach you things that you can't learn in a classroom, it creates the means to communicate on other planes.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin, and he's just written a new book. It's called Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin. It seems that a lot of the kind of medicine that is being done in the Amazon rainforest really mixes ceremony with healing. Is that something that you've thought about and even thought about what might be missing in the American form of medicine?
A colleague of mine who's a medical anthropologist, said that Western medicine often cures, but it doesn't heal. And I think what he means by that is this holistic approach to healing, which involves treating all aspects of the patient. So it's not just this magic bullet approach, which I think Western medicine has been obsessed with for quite some time. And I believe that indigenous healers who've been using things like visualization, massage, aromatherapy for thousands and thousands of years, I would find it highly ironic when Western medicine starts discovering things like visualization and massage and aromatherapy. So I believe that there are a lot of things we can learn from these people. First and foremost, new therapeutic compounds, but perhaps attitudes towards treating patients as well.
Tell us what these indigenous peoples can learn from Western medicine.
Well, in Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, I point out that there are medicines that we have that they don't have, which are effective for diseases which can really devastate an entire tribe. Things like mumps or measles, or basic treatments for the common cold, at least when they're bacterial in origin, and other things which have come in there which they couldn't treat because they haven't had long enough time to find a plant that can cure it. I believe that plants can cure just about any ailment, I won't say all of them, and some of these things we've introduced and we've developed very effective treatments for.
Well, you've been an ethnobotanist for more than a decade now. What plants have you been able to gather? And tell us what, as you've brought them back to the States here, if they've been made in any particular kinds of medicines or where that has taken medical research in this country.
Well, I've sat on my plants for the better part of a decade. I didn't want to turn it over to a pharmaceutical company which was going to find the cure for X, Y, or Z, synthesize it, make zillions of dollars, and leave the poor Indians in the dust. And as a result of this, there's been another groundswell in the ethnobotanical community to realize this type of cut-and-run approach is no longer viable. And a group of people got together and set up a company called Shaman Pharmaceuticals in the San Francisco area, which is predicated on the idea that not only are we going to find new and useful drugs from indigenous peoples, which in fact we have, but that a percentage of the proceeds should flow back to indigenous peoples, first and foremost, to the countries from which these plants come from, particularly these tropical countries, and into rainforest conservation as a whole. And now we at Conservation International, the environmental organization with which I work, are now brokering an agreement between indigenous peoples in the Northeast Amazon, the national government of Suriname, and a major pharmaceutical firm, to do just this sort of thing, which is to make sure that we are using ethnobotany as a guide and that make sure that a percentage of the profits go back to these peoples.
Tell us about an old football wound of yours, and this is something that has really dogged you for a lot of your adult life.
Well, fortunately, it doesn't dog me anymore,
right?
Because the medicine man cured it. I was living next to a gymnasium when I was in forestry school at Yale, and I guess I had a few too many hormones in my system at the time. I started lifting weights every day. So I damaged my elbow, what they call chronic tendonitis, which is a great diagnosis, except they couldn't cure it. So they gave me ultrasound, they gave me ice water baths, nothing happened. Then I went off to Harvard as a researcher and got this top-notch physician who made the same diagnosis and pumped me full of steroids. Not only did that not make me better, it hurt like hell. So finally I was down in Wayana country, and I found this great Wayana medicine man. And after collecting plants with him a few days, I was sufficiently impressed by his abilities as a healer to say, look, grandfather, you know, I've got this terrible problem with my elbow. Do you think you can treat it? Well, the guide, who was a young Wyana, said, hey, he says, look, he says, don't test this guy. He says, you know, this is a very serious and a very dangerous man. He says, I hope you're not doing this to test this guy, because this could get you in a lot of trouble. If you've got an injury, he can heal it. But don't be playing games with him. I said, I assure you, this is somebody that I would not be playing with. So the fellow brought me through an entire curing ceremony, building a hut of palm thatch in the jungle, treating me with tobacco smoke, magic herbs, chants, and it hasn't bothered me since.
You also describe a kind of out-of-body experience, or that you fell into a kind of a trance.
Well, I sort of felt myself going under, sort of like a hypnosis, hypnotic trance, and then I felt myself floating up, and I looked down, and there I lay. And somebody asked me recently, he says, well, certainly you're not suggesting this is the future of Western medicine. And I pointed out that I'm not suggesting that my physician friends here in the United States start trying to induce out-of-body experiences in all their patients. What I'm suggesting is that there are things from this man, from these plants, that we can learn and take advantage of through our own medical system.
Do you know what the plants were?
Professional secret.
Is that right?
He wouldn't tell me.
Oh, he wouldn't tell you. Well, then how are we supposed to learn all this stuff?
Well, you know, he didn't tip his hand. He didn't show all of his cards, but he taught me plenty plants, and there are leads in these plants which are worth following up. But, you know, I mean, this is just how people are that indulge in a trade. Nobody teaches you everything at the outset. And I might add that when I went back to learn from him, and I'd collected over 100 different plants he used for medical purposes, he was one of the famous, one of the paramount shamans of the tribe. When I finally got back down there to work with him, it was too late because he died out.
Oh, gosh. When you're sick in the United States, what do you do for the sort of everyday illnesses, the fevers, the headaches, the earaches?
Well, I can't answer that in any one way because it depends on the illness and depends on where I am. Because there are things that I go to the physician for. If I have acute appendicitis, I want to be treated by a surgeon. But if I have a fungal infection of the skin, I wait till I get back in the rainforest and use the plants that the indigenous peoples have taught me. I've had stomach ailments coming out of the fact that I've had parasites so many damn times, which Western physicians really couldn't treat successfully. So I went to a fellow who was practicing Chinese medicine, and he cleared me right up. I mean, the point, again, is that no system has all of the answers, and you have to be willing to experiment and try different systems to find what may be best for you.
You've described the difficulty, or at least the changes that are happening inside some of these indigenous villages in the Amazon rainforest, and the concern that you have about protecting them from the outside world. Is there a danger at all of you being paternalistic about that kind of protection?
Well, I think there is a danger, and I'm not the one who decides what they learn and what they don't learn. What I want to do is make sure they know the value of their own culture and not giving up everything and throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I point out, I'm not telling that everything we have is wrong and that they shouldn't be wearing clothes or they shouldn't be having radios. What I'm telling them is giving up their medicines is a real mistake because there are many instances of them getting hooked on outside medicines, and then the missionaries go away, or the government officials go away, or economic chaos happens in these third world countries, and they don't have access to outside medicines, and then they're left with nothing. No Western medicine, no indigenous medicine.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Plotkin is author of Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. He's also vice president of ethnobotany at Conservation International. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, growing up on the Spokane Indian Reservation, we talk with Native American writer Sherman Alexie. His poems and stories have been described as wide-ranging, dexterous, and consistently capable of raising your neck hair. His new collection of short stories about life on the reservation is called The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven. And NYPD Blue, the new cop show from Stephen Bochco, premieres tonight. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, opponents of Russian President Boris Yeltsin have reacted angrily to his suspension of the Russian parliament and announcement of new elections to be called in December. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Vice President Alexander Rutskoy and parliament leader Ruslan Hasbulatov both labeled Yeltsin's action tonight a coup d'etat. Hasbulatov called on the Russian nation to rise up against it. Rutskoy declared that he is now the president of Russia on the basis of an article in the current constitution that automatically strips the president of power if he acts unconstitutionally. The leadership of the parliament also fell in line behind Rutskoy. Yeltsin announced tonight that he is dissolving the current parliament because it has refused political compromise and has blocked reforms at every turn. It's the only way, Yeltsin said, to safeguard democracy and freedom. Yeltsin also said elections for a new two-chamber parliament will be held on December 11th and 12th. Vice President Rutskoy claimed that Interior Ministry troops are on the move toward Moscow, but there has as yet been no confirmation of any such troop movements. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Also in Moscow, that nation's constitutional court has ruled that Yeltsin is in violation of the Russian constitution and may be impeached. In Washington, President Clinton and Secretary of State Warren Christopher have voiced their support for Yeltsin. Mr. Clinton telephoned Yeltsin this afternoon and afterwards said in a written statement that in a democracy, people should decide issues at the heart of debate, and that President Yeltsin made this choice and Mr. Clinton supports him fully. Mr. Clinton said that he was told by Yeltsin that new elections, he has called, will be held on a democratic and free basis. A PLO supporter in the Gaza Strip has been assassinated, apparently by rival PLO members. He was the first Palestinian official killed since Israel and the PLO signed an agreement. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
35-year-old Mohammed Abu Shaban was a Gaza lawyer and the head of a committee organizing support for the PLO-Israel agreement for Palestinian self-rule in the occupied territories. Palestinian hospital officials said Abu Shaban was returning from a rally in support of the peace agreement when a car filled with masked men pulled up beside him and killed him in a hail of bullets. Family members and others of the mainstream Fatah faction of the PLO said they believe the attackers were rival members of Fatah and not from the Islamic fundamentalist Hamas movement. But the incident showed the potential for violence both within the PLO and between different Palestinian organizations. According to the agreement, the Israeli army is scheduled to pull out of much of the Gaza Strip within 6 months. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 38 points to close at 3,537.24 on volume of more than 300 million shares. Trading again today was heavy. This is NPR News. National Security Advisor Anthony Lake says it's only a matter of time before U.S. forces are pulled out of Somalia, and he said that there will be no unilateral move by the United States into Bosnia. Lake said, however, that continued fighting in Bosnia does mean a certain degree of U.S. engagement and that Washington is committed to helping gain an acceptable peace agreement there. Lake said that there will be more and more calls for the U.S. to intervene in other nations, but he said there will be very few instances that justify intervention. Congress has passed and sent to President Clinton a measure allowing federal employees to become actively involved in political campaigns. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Since 1939, federal employees have been barred from soliciting campaign donations from fellow employees, using their office for partisan political purposes, or taking an active role in political campaigns. The new law would not allow the nation's 3 million federal employees to run for office. However, most would be allowed to distribute campaign material, solicit political contributions from employee organizations, and take part in the full range of political activities on their own time. The measure was widely supported by both parties, and President Clinton is expected to quickly sign it. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
House Democratic Leader Richard Gephardt has announced his opposition to the North America Free Trade Agreement and says that he will take an active part in debate on Capitol Hill. Gephardt's opposition and plans for an active role in consideration of the agreement are viewed as a setback by the White House. The president lacks enough votes for approval of the measure, mainly because of fears within his own party over possible job losses, environmental concerns, and the pace of political changes now underway in Mexico. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sherman Alexie is a Spokane Coeur d'Alene Indian, and at the age of 26, a newcomer to the literary world. He grew up on a reservation near Spokane, Washington, and now lives in Spokane. He's written several books of poetry and has a new collection of short stories called The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. His writing chronicles contemporary Indian life, from the poverty on the reservation to the rich spiritual traditions. Sherman Alexie wrote in one of his stories that imagination was a weapon on the reservation. I asked him what he meant.
It wasn't as much protecting me from something as in giving me hope toward the future, giving me those tools and those ideas which enable me to rise above the conditions on a reservation. And in sense of, I guess, protecting me against the despair and depression and anger and pain that can, you know, easily erupt on a reservation also. I mean, you create these whole other worlds for yourself that are better than the one you're in.
When did you begin to write?
About 5 years ago, I took a creative writing class in college because I needed the credits. And
really?
Yes. And my writing teacher, the first assignment was to hand in five poems. So I went and wrote them, and then I handed him under his door early. And then the next week of class, he took me outside before the class, and I thought he was going to tell me, you know, that you shouldn't take this class, you know, you don't want to take this class. But then he asked me what I was doing for the rest of my life, and I told him I had no idea, and he said I should write. So
when he said that to you, you really should think seriously about being a writer. What did that do to kind of change your view of what you thought your life would be?
Well, I was at a very malleable point in my life, so having a figure who I instantly respected, Alex Kuo is his name, he's also a writer, at the college, having a respected figure like that, somebody who I thought was a good writer, tell me that, I thought, well, I mean, I should be listening, and I needed that kind of guidance at the time, needed something of a father figure.
Describe for us the reservation that you grew up in, and this was what, outside of Spokane, Washington?
Yes, it's just about 45 miles northwest of Spokane, Washington. It's a Spokane Indian reservation. It's a rather small reservation, a small tribe, but it's you know, it's pretty isolated. It's very mountainous, pine tree forests, a lot of lakes and streams, and like most reservations, you know, 80% unemployment, a lot of depression, a lot of alcoholism, a lot of all kinds of addictions, but there's also, like other reservations, a real spiritual sense and a lot of people living the best they can under the circumstances and surviving and doing well spiritually and emotionally, even though they may not be doing well financially.
Your father worked for the BIA, though, is that right?
He was off and on employment for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Spokane Tribe. We also had some farmland where there was a small amount of income. He is an alcoholic, and was a binge drinker, which prevented him from holding a job for very long periods of time.
What effect do you think his drinking had on you?
Aside from any of the, dysfunctional family issues that come up, you know, issues of abandonment or whatever, I mean, it affected me by seeing somebody that you loved very much, somebody who was, in most respects, a very good man, a very kind man and a loving father, a very gentle person and a very sensitive and emotional man, broken and defeated by the reservation and by his own failed dreams. So, I mean, what that gave to me was a real sense of insecurity about my own dreams and about my own expectations of myself, you know, things I still carry around.
How elaborate were his dreams?
He grew up pretty much like me, in fact, because I ended up going to a white high school just off the reservation, and he went to a white Catholic high school in Coeur d'Alene. So, and he was bright, and he was, you know, athletic and talented and very intelligent. In fact, he was Coeur d'Alene City Foxtrot champion in 1956, you know. So he had a certain amount of outside influence. You know, he was involved in the dominant culture way earlier than a lot of people are, a lot of Indians of his generations are. So, you know, he had the dreams of college and of, you know, big jobs and that kind of thing. And he ended up back on the reservation because of a various number of reasons. So he had as large of dreams as I ever did.
Well, was he offered the opportunity to go to college? How close did he get to that?
He didn't have the money. He didn't have, you know, the experience. He didn't know how to get to college. He was scared of it. He didn't have the help that I did and, you know, other Indians have done in my generation. So he was left pretty much alone in those decisions, even within his family who, you know, nobody had gone to college. You know, few had graduated high school, in fact. So it was a matter of being completely alone in his decisions, mm-hmm. and he didn't have enough courage or knowledge to make those decisions correctly.
What was he like when he was drunk?
Oh, he was still a very gentle man. Really? It was never he was never a violent man. He's never been a violent man. It was just that he would leave.
He'd physically leave.
He would not be in the house for however long. I mean, the binges have decreased incredibly in frequency. They don't happen, you know, once a year maybe now. But at the time it was happening, he'd leave for, you know, 2-3 weeks and be gone during that time. So, I mean, it's not a matter of physical violence, but it certainly was emotionally violent to have your father gone for those periods of time.
How pervasive, then, is drinking on at least the particular reservation that you grew up in? And again, I'll just say that in your book, there are many, many references to drinking and drinking too much.
Yeah, well, it's very pervasive on a reservation, of course. You know, there are more alcoholics among Native Americans than in the general population, but just to make a point, there are also more total abstainers among Native Americans than in the general population. So certainly alcoholism is a specific problem for Native Americans, and it's something I address because it affected me deeply. But, I mean, there's not a family in this country that has not been affected deeply by alcoholism.
When did you start drinking?
Actually, when I was 18, I didn't drink all. I've never drank on a reservation, which is a thing, and I never saw more drinking than I ever did at college, you know.
Well, did you hold off on drinking until you got to college because of what effect it had on your father?
Yeah, it was part of it, seeing all that going on a day-to-day basis. And then, I mean, I was sort of arrogant about it, too. And then when I got to college and got that serious culture shock and started losing hope in myself, that insecurity, that feeling like I was a failure, not going to be able to be as good as these other white kids in the school, not being as smart or as successful or as, you know, all those good things I didn't think I would be able to do. And so I started into the alcohol then as a way of numbing all that pain and insecurity.
My guest is writer Sherman Alexie. His new collection of short stories is called The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. We'll be back with a reading after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Sherman Alexie is my guest. Here's an excerpt from his story, Family Portrait.
The television was always loud, too loud, until every conversation was distorted, fragmented. Dinner sounded like leave me alone. I love you sounded like inertia. Please sounded like sacrifice. Believe me, the television was always too loud. At 3 a.m, I woke from ordinary nightmares to hear the television pounding the ceiling above my bed. Sometimes it was just white noise, the end of another broadcasting days. Other times it was a bad movie made worse by the late hour and interrupted sleep. Drop your weapons and come out with your hands above your head. Sounded too much like trust me, the world is yours. The aliens are coming, the aliens are coming. Sounded too much like just one more beer, sweetheart, and then we'll go home. Junior, I lost the money. Sounded too much like you'll never have a dream come true. I don't know where all the years went. I remember only the television in detail. All the other moments worth remembering became stories that changed with each telling until nothing was aboriginal or recognizable. For instance, in the summer of 1972 or 1973 or only in our minds, the reservation disappeared. I remember standing on the front porch of our HUD house, practicing on my plastic saxophone when the reservation disappeared. Finally, I remember thinking. But I was 6 years old or seven. I don't know for sure how old. I was Indian. And just like that, there was nothing there beyond the bottom step. My older brother told me he'd give me a quarter if I jumped into the unknown. My twin sisters cried equal tears. Their bicycles had been parked out by the pine trees. All of it vanished. And my mother, she came out to investigate the noise. She stared out past the bottom step for a long time. But there was no expression on her face when she went back to wash the potatoes. My father was happily drunk, and he stumbled off the bottom step before any of us could stop him. He came back years later with diabetes and a pocketful of quarters. The seeds in the cuffs of his pants dropped to the floor of our house and grew into orange trees. Nothing is possible without vitamin C, my mother told us. But I knew she meant to say, don't want everything so much.
That's such a powerful passage there. And for me, there's several things going on. One, of course, I think is true for many families. I think for all families, which is what is said and what is meant. The kind of disconnect, and sometimes even the good disconnect between the sort of intention and the reality. Is that something you felt you grew up with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we all talk in symbols. You know, there's this whole huge language thing going on that you get these shared symbols even in a family where it's this little culture going on where all these things happening, you're communicating through these codes and these words that have only a specific meaning for the family. And you miss things, too, because people are changing the language all the time. So you never exactly know what's going on in a family. The communication channels are always a little distorted.
Let me ask you how you were able to give up the drinking and even how bad it got.
Well, there's two versions I tell, one for the non-believers and one for the believers. So the non-believer version is that I quit drinking because I was tired of being sick and that I knew I needed to quit drinking in order to pursue what I wanted to be with this writer. I knew I was getting looked at as a role model and a successful Native American. I knew that did not include alcohol. The second reason, the believer's reason, is that I had a dream. My grandmother, Big Mom, came to me in a dream and told me to quit drinking.
Hmm. Which do you believe?
Oh, the dream.
The dream, of course. There's another section I'd like to have you read.
Okay, and this is from a story called All I Wanted to Do Was Dance. Victor was dancing with a Lakota woman in a Montana bar. He had no idea why he was there. He couldn't even remember how he arrived. All he knew was that he was dancing with the 100th Indian woman in the 100 dancing days since the white woman he loved had left him. This dancing was his compensation, his confession, largest sin and penance. You're beautiful, he said to the Lakota woman. And you're drunk, she said. But she was beautiful, with hair and eyes so dark and long. He imagined she was a reservation eclipse, full. He needed special glasses to look at her. He could barely survive her reflection. You're a constellation, he said. And you're really drunk, she said. Then she was gone, and he was laughing, dancing through the bar all by himself. He wanted to sing, but he couldn't think of any lyrics. He was drunk, bruised by whiskey, brutal. His hair was electricity. I started World War I, he shouted. I shot Lincoln. He was underwater drunk, staring up at the faces of his past. He recognized Neil Armstrong and Christopher Columbus, his mother and father, James Dean, Sal Mineo, Natalie Wood. He staggered, fell against other dancers, found himself in the back seat of a grasshopper as it traveled uneasily down reservation dirt roads. Where are we? He asked a flathead driver with insane braids. Heading back to Arleek, cousin. You said you wanted a ride. Shoot, all I wanted to do was dance.
Do you remember feeling that way when you were drinking?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about feeling guilty about everything that ever happened, you know, you get that, I shot Kennedy, I shot Lincoln, I shot every president that's been shot. You know, I shot Reagan, I'm responsible for earthquakes and tornadoes, you know. My father and my mother are this way because of me, my friends are this way because of me, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of guilt.
There's a lot of grandiosity, too.
Oh, I mean, you know, the self-pitying martyr routine, you know, it's huge. And the you know, the fatalistic, narcissistic aspects of all that. I mean, there's some sort of, you know, dignity about being an Indian destroying yourself with alcohol.
Are you saying that ironically?
Very ironically. Yeah.
My guest is Sherman Alexi, and he's a Spokane Coeur d'Alene Indian. He's also a writer, a poet. He's got a book of poetry coming out very soon called First Indian on the Moon. And he was just reading from a new collection of short stories called The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. You left the reservation, the reservation you grew up in. How old were you when you left?
Well, I lived there until I was 18. I went to the white high school. I drove off the reservation to go to a white high school. I left the reservation to go to college, and I've only lived there for a brief time period after I finished college. But I live in Spokane now, which is, you know, just close to the reservation for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is because I like cable television.
Is that always on in your apartment?
It's always on. I'm cross-cultural. And the other reason is because, I mean, there's a lot of pain associated with the reservation. A lot of bad memories and a lot of, it's hard to see friends and former friends and even people I didn't necessarily get along with falling apart.
Is that what happens to them when they stay behind?
A lot of them, not all of them, certainly not all of them, but a majority. And it's hard to see that. And, you know, you get your heart broken on a daily basis. And, you know, I have enough pain in my life as it is.
Do you feel, I mean, you mentioned the sort of guilt associated with drinking. Do you feel any guilt associated with living off the reservation?
Oh yeah, certainly. I have survivor's guilt, for one, of being successful and doing well and seeing a lot of other people who were bright and very good people not make it for a variety of reasons. So certainly I have survivor's guilt. And I have guilt living off my reservation, being apart from my people like that. But they haven't necessarily always embraced me either.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I was different, you know. I was always driven to make a life for myself beyond the reservation boundaries, beyond the tribal boundaries. So that wasn't necessarily viewed as a good thing by a lot of people, and those people still don't think it's a good thing.
But when you go back, and I assume you do, I mean, you said you did, you go back to see family, to see friends. What does that feel like for you? I mean, is it feel more and more foreign as time goes on?
I don't think it feels more and more foreign, but it certainly feels foreign. You know, when I'm driving back onto the reservation, I always feel like it's the start of some really bad TV movie, you know, that if they ever filmed it, because you got this semi-prodigal son returning home to the reservation, to his people and his tribe. So I always feel that way. And then I drive to the house and have dinner and play a little basketball with my little brother and his friends, and then it feels fine. But there's a real nervousness and fear and tension in me when I'm driving onto the reservation, but it usually relaxes as I spend a little more time around my family, and then it increases as my family and I bring up, you know, the same old problems that we always do.
Writer Sherman Alexi, his book of short stories is called The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us. Linda, what stories will you have on All Things Considered today?
We have a major story coming out of Russia, Marty. Boris Yeltsin has dismissed the Russian parliament, which has in turn dismissed him, and we're trying to sort that out. The man who will be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Shalikashvili, we have a profile of him. On the North American Free Trade Agreement, House Majority Leader Richard Gebhardt has come out against it. We'll hear from an executive of Zenith about why he is for it and discuss the schism among environmentalists on NAFTA. We'll be covering health care reform, including a story on why we say what we do about it in polls, and an obituary for the Postal Buddy.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on ABC, the most controversial new show of the fall TV season will finally be judged by viewers, except in those cities where local station managers have deemed it unfit for broadcast and removed it from their local lineups. The series in question is NYPD Blue, a drama about New York City cops on and off the job. As you'll hear in TV critic David Bianculli's review, one of the points of controversy is the language.
Hey, Miss District Attorney, you really prosecuted the crap out of that one.
I went with the crap I had, Detective.
Whoa, you think that was a Hummer bust, huh? You saying I queered that guy's tire?
I'd say res ipsa loquitur if I thought you knew what it meant.
Hey, ipsa this, you pissy little bitch.
NYPD Blue has been called broadcast TV's first R-rated series. It's gotten pressure groups and station managers all upset, and it's gotten tons of free press. But I've got news for you. If you're expecting to be either outraged or amazed by the sex and language in NYPD Blue, you're expecting too much. If you're conservative about these things, it isn't that shocking. And if you're liberal, it isn't that shocking. There's only one sex scene in the three episodes I've watched, and the second episode has almost nothing that couldn't have been shown or said on Hill Street Blues. The only really shocking thing about NYPD Blue is how good it is. And that's what counts, especially in a season where there are more news magazines than hour-long dramas. NYPD Blue is the latest series from Stephen Bochco, whose partner this time is David Milch. Although Bochco always gets most of the credit, his best work comes when he's had a strong production and writing partner to help launch his shows. Bochco and Michael Kozol co-created Hill Street Blues, and Terry Louise Fisher co-created L.A. Law. If NYPD Blue doesn't get swallowed by this stupid controversy stuff, it'll rank right up there with those two triumphs. It's an ensemble show with a handful of stars, and two of them stand out early. One of them is Dennis Franz, who played Norman Bunce on Hill Street. Here, he plays an alcoholic cop named Sipowicz, and David Caruso plays his partner, John Kelly. Sipowicz gets most of the dialogue that puts the blue in NYPD Blue, but most of it sounds very natural and credible. Here he is getting reprimanded by his lieutenant, who's played by James McDaniel. Mind your ears.
I just had a call from the federal marshals.
Is that so?
What the hell were you doing at Giardella's hotel?
I was in the neighborhood. I thought I'd say hello.
I don't get you. You know you're on probation, and you go down there and put on a bozo act.
That asshole shot me.
I know he shot you.
And now the DA's putting him up in some joint where I can't afford to buy a cup of coffee.
I agree. They never should have cut Giardella a deal.
Yeah, but I'm not supposed to be pissed off.
You can be as pissed off as you want. What you can't do is go down there and try to brain him with a potted plant.
I use bad judgment, right? Look, maybe if I was a little busier.
It's like the chicken and the egg. First you stop acting like a flake, then maybe you get back on the street.
Lieutenant, look, I've been taking the psycho calls, filing the stop and frisk reports, doing the community policing logs.
Start.
Is that being a flake, huh? How long is this probation thing gonna go on?
I told you, I'm giving myself time to make up my mind.
I think you've already made up your mind, Lieutenant. And I think you're trying to screw me from behind that desk.
These first shows are written and performed so well, you not only believe in these characters, but care about them and can't wait for the next episode. If you loved Hill Street, and you still miss the complexities and surprises of a series like St. Elsewhere, then NYPD Blue is your kind of show. I swear.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the life and history of Yasser Arafat. Our guests will be British journalist Andrew Gowers, co-author of Behind the Myth, Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Revolution, an account of Arafat's life before and after his emergence as a leader of the Palestinian movement. Join us for the next Fresh Air.